Colossians chapter 3. Yep. Starting in verse 22. Bondservants, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service as men pleasers, but in sincerity of heart, fearing God. And whatever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance, for you serve the Lord Christ. But he who does wrong will be repaid for what he's done. There is no partiality. The word used here for bondservant is the picture of one who has decided, maybe they got there under lousy circumstances, but decided to stay in the end. That's a bondservant. This isn't an abused slave situation. This is a situation of someone who is there willingly, and Paul is addressing them as believers and saying to them that there is a way to handle yourself for modern day terms, employer. There's a way to handle your employer, and there's a way to be a godly man or woman by obeying, being submitted to authority, and not with eye service. Now, what do you think eye service means?
On the outside.
On the outside. What would another way of saying it be also? Superficial. In the place of the employment, what would someone who is just giving eye service look like in a place of employment?
A suck up.
What else?
Only doing the work
when the boss sees them doing the work. When the boss isn't around, they sit in the back room at the end of the hallway in their little cave eating snacks and talking on the phone.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
You got to know how to do it.
You got to know. There's a skill to it. It's like George Costanza. You remember George Costanza made the bed underneath his desk, had the alarm clock in there, showed up early in the morning. The boss saw him. Look at George. He's so timely and punctual. And then he closes the door, and he goes underneath. He's got this bed laid out underneath his desk. He had a special design, the way the desk was built. He's got an alarm clock in there. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, an alarm goes up. He stretches, gets up, comes out, gets his briefcase, and goes home. It's terrible. That's eye service right there, right? Not with eye service as men pleasers, but in sincerity of heart, fearing God. Fearing God. So it's really, really something that we're going to talk about tonight is so important. Whatever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord. Now, in Genesis chapter 1, turn to Genesis chapter 1 with me. Starting in verse 27, God makes man in his own image. In verse 27, it says, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male, female, he created them. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves. For I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is in the face of the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed, so that you may, it shall be for food. And then every beast of the field and bird of the air and everything that creeps on the earth in which there is life, I have given every green herb for food. And so it was. God saw everything he made, and indeed it was very good. So evening and morning came the sixth day. So God is a worker. God made. God is a worker. Everybody understands that, right? God is a worker. We have a working God. We don't have a lazy, uninvolved God that maybe a deist might name God as being someone who just did some work in the past and doesn't do anything anymore. And some of them would say, well, isn't this in the past? Well, the Bible also says we are his workmanship currently. God is currently working, right? It is God who works in you both to will and to do his good pleasure in Colossians chapter 2. So God is a worker. He who began a good work in you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ, Philippians 1, verse 6. Amen? Hello? So God is a worker, and we've been made in God's image, and we've been made to do what? Work. This is something that a lot of people don't understand. God has made us to work. Now, I got to tell you that there are many believers who unfortunately have been influenced by the Kenneth Copeland, Kenneth Hagin, faith movement type of thing, where in all actuality, they just want God to wave the magic wand and bring prosperity. They just want God to do the work and for them to reap the benefit. And I'm not saying that God doesn't do the majority of everything. Please don't misunderstand me. But what I am saying is God is expecting us to work. And God, in this verse, Paul does not tell the bondservants to, you know, just tithe and God will bless them and they won't have to work. You know, because in all actuality, if you were to take what the faith movement teaches to its logical conclusion, you would say, listen, if you have enough faith, you'll have enough money and you won't have to work. But they don't say that. They say, as long as you give to me or to us or to something, then God will bless you and you may have something, whatever. Right? So that's what the faith movement, so the faith movement is illogical and it's unreasonable. Not only is it unscriptural, it's illogical and unreasonable. So this is where we have the problem. Is that God expects us to work and to earn a living. You know, God told Adam, I mean, if anybody, here's a perfect man in the garden, God could have just told him, listen, I've given you all this stuff, but he put him in the garden to tend it. Hello? Now, if God was just going to bless him and not have him work for it, would he had him just tend it? He wouldn't even have to tend it. I'll tend it for you. I'll tend your field. I'll raise your animals. I'll do all that. You wouldn't have to name them. I'll do all that for you. And you just pray. And if you have enough faith, you sit back and I'll bless your finances. I'll make sure you have everything you need and you won't have to do a darn thing. But what garbage is that? What total spiritual dumbness is that? It doesn't even make any sense. Because if they did teach that in its fullness, the faith movement I'm talking about, for those who walked in late, I'm talking about the Copeland Hagin brand of the faith movement. That, you know, you frankly would just say, listen, just if you have enough faith, God will bless you. You don't have to go to work. Why even go to work? Why does a faith movement tell people they should go back to work on Monday if they just get laid hands on Sunday? Hey, walk by faith. God will bless you. You don't have to go to work Monday. You'll have all the money you need. You'll have all the riches and wealth. Doesn't God want you all to be rich? If God wants you to be rich, why do you have to work for it? Doesn't make any sense. Because they don't tell you you got to work to be blessed if you're giving. They say, if you're giving, God will honor your giving. Well, then all I'll do is I'll give. And then when I get some more from God, I'll give some more. Then I get some more from God, I'll give some more. Get some more. I'll just have like a little trade thing going on. My stocks will keep going up with God, and I won't have to go to work. But God is a worker. He is working now, and he expects us to do what? Work. And he expects us to work in a manner that pleases him. He expects us to work in a way that, you know, honors the Lord. Not as unto men, but unto him. Fearing God, having an awe of God. And that means that you are respecting the God who created you and the reason why and the manner in which you have been created. By the way, this is why unemployed people do terribly. Mentally and spiritually. You leave someone out of work. You have all these people that out of work. First of all, they're out of work. Maybe it's no fault of their own. They're out of work. They feel horrible being out of work. They lose their value. They lose their sense of worth. They start to get distracted. Then a lot of people choose to be out of work and they collect from the government. And what do? Eventually they get in all kinds of problems. They get in all kinds of mischief. Now, I've always thought if you're going to collect unemployment, I wish our government was smart enough to say, listen, you're unemployed. We will give you a temporary spot to do something, and we're going to assign you to local businesses, and you can help those local businesses, or you can help with road crews, or you can do something while you're unemployed. You're not just going to sit back, collect money, and go to one job site a week, bring one application. I remember one guy was on unemployment, and I asked him, I said, how long have you been on unemployment? 26 weeks. I said, do you have to go? Oh, I have to report every week. How long is the meeting? 15 minutes. And what do you tell them? Well, I got to tell them where I applied for jobs. I said, well, how many do you have to apply for? They don't say. I said, they don't tell you got to apply every day and try to find work every day? I said, no, as long as you're making an effort. So there's an arbitrary making an effort, and you can make the effort, or maybe you don't make the effort, you know? What kind of effort? Here's the effort you ought to put in. If you don't have a job, let me just say this. If you're out of work and you're capable of working, you ought to be spending 40 hours a week looking for a job. That's your new full-time job, finding a job. And it's not going to take you 40 hours. Believe me, you could find a job. If you asked me where you could find a job, I could direct you to five places right now you could find a job. But the other problem is people want to be picky about what they make. They want to come, they want to graduate high school, and they want to have what mom and dad built for 30 or 40 years. They want to have the house, the new car, and all that other stuff. Now, if you're smart, you watched mom and dad, you watched them save, you watched them budget. I think what you ought to do is finish your school, start making a little bit of money, make sure you're tithing, make sure you're saving, have a good budget, pay attention, live home as long as you possibly can. Live free as you possibly, as long as you can. Live free. Eat free as long as you can. That's my counsel to you. Eat free. I told David, eat free as long as you can. I don't have a problem with that. You've been eating free for 18 years. A few more years ain't going to bankrupt me. By now, we figured out how to cheat you out of certain foods. We're just getting good at cutting corners with the food budget. You can stay as long as you want now, you know. Besides, when you live free in my house, you help with certain things around the house.
Amen.
A little bit. No, we're not slave drivers or anything like that. But you know why? I met one young man at one point. He says, I can't wait to get out of my parents' house. I said, okay. So I said, I want you to meet with Menzo and talk about budget. So he sat down with Menzo, and Menzo went over a budget of him living on his own. He came back later and said, I think I'm going to live home for a while. And Menzo did that many times with even his own kids when they started talking about, I want to move out. I think we're going to go here or go there. And I know that he met with a couple of them and went through the budget and said, okay, here's what it costs for rent. Here's what it costs for insurance. Here's what your car's going to cost. Here's what it's going to cost for upkeep. Here's what you're going to go. Oh, you want an apartment? You got to buy dishes. You got to buy silverware. You have to buy things. You have to buy ketchup and mustard and salt and pepper. You got to stock the place with stuff. You can't just, food doesn't automatically appear. You don't just swing the fridge open and the light goes on and the light is this magical spell that brings food into existence in a fridge. But back to unemployment. People that are unemployed will get into mischief, sometimes even crime. Or they get involved with causes that they really shouldn't, they don't have any business getting involved with. But I just want to say this, work is not limited to what we'd call our jobs. Our job is what we do to put bread on the table and a roof over our heads. Job is what you do for a paycheck. Our work is what we do for purpose. God created us to work. Hello? Now, there is a process to finding your purpose. Somebody says, I don't know what my purpose is. I collect garbage. Really? Can you imagine what the world would be like if people didn't collect this stuff? You can't find a purpose. I would challenge you. You can find a high purpose in every job you've ever had. And by the way, we've all had some of the worst jobs and some of the best jobs. What was, let's take a survey. What was the, how many of you could tell me what your worst job was? The worst job you ever had, what was it? Raise your hand, anybody? Karen?
Telemarketing.
For your business.
Thanks. You know, I could tell you who my most overpaid employee was.
No, telemarketing isn't fun.
Oh, it's miserable. That's why I hired somebody to do it. What about, what? Who else? Who else had a horrible job? Worst job ever. Worst job in history. Huh?
Mason's laborer.
Oh. Mason's laborer in the summer. Worst job ever. Wow. I think my worst job ever was that plumber. I can't help but go back to that plumber. You know, but it wasn't just the job with the work itself. The work itself wasn't bad. It was the employer that was horrible. You know. How about your best job? Who could tell me what their best job, most favorite fun job ever was? Maybe it's your current one. That's fine. Who could tell me their favorite job ever? John, what was your favorite job ever? We'll wait till you find new employment, and then you can tell us. You don't really know how?
I enjoyed being a supplier engineer. I got to go visit people that, you know, own businesses and built them.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, you heard about the story, the risk that they took, and the effort that they put in to build the business, and the pride and the value that they had in it. And you know, you were, my role was kind of a liaison between them and our design engineers to bring back some feedback to help our design engineers improve the product and make it easier to machine, and then help the shops make money and give us a product we could use.
Yeah.
It was fun.
That's good. I've had a lot of favorite jobs. I really have. I've liked most of what I've done. I think, of course, being the pastor is my absolute favorite. But I think there were other ones, like being the puppeteer at the amusement park. That was a blast. That was the ultimate blast, you know. But in the book Working by a guy named Studs Terzel, this woman makes a comment, Nora Watson. She makes this very interesting and insightful comment. She says, I think what most of us are looking for is a calling and not a job. Most of us, like the assembly line worker, have jobs that are too small for our spirit. Jobs that are not big enough for the person. And I think, like, one of the reasons why people get very stuck and they get in a rut at work is two things. Number one, they forget how big the role actually is. And secondly, if the role doesn't fit them, it's not big enough for them. I'll be honest, I'm a fan of, you know, not waiting for the perfect situation to make a move. I mean, I think I scare my wife once in a while. But I see something big and I look at it and I say, I want that. I want to try that. I want to do that. Why? Because I love to find things that are bigger than me. Because when I get involved with them and I find out that they are too big for me personally, then I have to find God in them. And God always seems to show up. And that's really the miracle of finding a calling. It's not, you know, you're not going to be led into something that you're ready for. Most of us would tell you, in the most interesting things we've done, we weren't ready to do them. I was not ready to be a pastor of a church. You know, I was not ready as a 23-year-old to have 15 employees. I wasn't ready. But I learned from that. I stepped into that, and God led me into those things. And I learned a great deal from God during those times. So Can you find and name the purpose in your job for the big picture? Like right now, your job is a big picture job. I know what everyone in the room does. And I think all of you have big picture jobs. If you think about what you do, and I'm talking about even the guy who makes pizza. You know, I can tell you, because I've insured so many restaurants over the years, and know restaurant owners and business owners. And I can tell you, when you have an employee who puts out, who puts his heart into what he does and works hard, like there, I can think of three or four customers that I have that have a couple of key employees, and those key employees make their business what it is and allow their businesses to be successful enough to employ people so that those employees can feed their families and those employees can have work and have an income. And usually it's 10, 20% of the workforce in those places that's doing it. You go to most job sites or businesses that have, you know, more than 5 or 10 employees, and it's usually there's one or two of them that are those standout employees. They're there all the time. They're on time. They work hard. They help everybody else. They do their job with integrity. They do it with love. They do it with compassion. They see the big picture. What makes the business what it is? What makes the organization what it is? It depends a lot upon what you do in your part. If you don't take your small part of the big thing seriously, then you will never discover what your purpose is and what you're doing. And if you can't find it in flipping pizza or driving a, you know, delivery truck or whatever it is, if you're not going to find it there, then the next big thing you're looking for, you won't see it when it comes. Because you've got to be looking for it now. You have to take where you are right now and see the purpose in it. It's not just a job. The mistake made during the Renaissance period was to separate the secular from the sacred. We don't make that separation. We don't separate the secular from the sacred. Your job is not your natural, you know, this life over here, and then your spirituality and your church life is something over here. Just like when we talk about dying and going to heaven, your body isn't some, you know, oh, it's just the body, throw it in the ground, blah, blah, blah. God's going to resurrect that. He's going to redeem the human body. Why? Because the body is important. The body has value to God. The body was made by Him. So we're in the workplace. We don't have this secular employment and then the spiritual life over here. The way you are in your workplace is a big indicator of where you're at spiritually. If you're lousy at work, your spiritual temperature is very low. If you have a bad attitude in your workplace, I'll guarantee you, you're not right with God. You have an issue. You have an issue with God. Why? Because as Jason talked about this on Sunday, unto the Lord, not unto men, not as men pleasers of this eye service thing, but you're doing what you're doing unto the Lord. And that tells a lot about your walk with God. A lot of people retire and they disappear into la la land, and they get to retire and end up playing shuffleboard and going down, you know, sitting on their glumpy all day long and, you know, not doing anything, you know? And what happens to that person? They get sick. This hurts. This starts to hurt. This hurts. By the way, if you notice, it hurts anyway. When you're working, it hurts. Then when you get older and you're retired, oh, now all they do is talk about what hurts. You got nothing else to talk about. Every now and then I'll go to the diner. There's a star diner, and I'll meet there's a couple guys there that are elderly guys, and whenever I come in the diner, ah, Jerry, come over, sit with us. And I go over and sit with them because I love these guys, but, oh, I dread the conversations, you know. Oh, how'd that bunion work out on your foot? Oh, I don't know. I think I got one on my forehead. You know, whatever it is. I mean, they just, you know, then they just go through all this stuff, and that's all they got to talk. What are you going to do today? Oh, I'm probably going to go home and watch TV, or maybe I'll go home, ride the lawnmower around it. Blah, blah, blah. It's like, oh, my goodness gracious. Lost their purpose. Purpose lost. Some of these veterans we deal with at the American Legion, we have a lot of really amazing people there, but we also have those that are down at the bar at 11:45 every day. See, Somebody said to me, well, if that's the case, then why are you part of the American Legion? Because there are people at a bar at 11:45, and I can go in there and have an impact on their life. That's why I'm part of the Legion. There's people that have lost the reason and lost their purpose. And you know, then you watch guys like Joe, for example. Joe retired. How many years ago did you actually retire? There's nobody busier in this church than Joe. Why? Because he knows he has a purpose. You know? And, you know, your wife, even, you know, you have a couple with an aging parent or an ailing parent, whatever you want to call it, that becomes your job. And what a high purpose that is, to bring honor to a parent in the later years of life. And bring dignity and ministry and compassion and love and care and concern. That's a high calling. That's a very high calling. Not something that should be discounted or, well, it's just, I got to do it. Well, there are certain things we have to do. Like we have to go to work. We have to get up in the morning and go to our job because we need money to pay bills. But at the same time, as a Christian, I have a higher purpose than that. I have a greater reason to do what I do. I want to say many of your frustrated coworkers are probably too big for the jobs that they have. I had somebody work for me a while back and just heard constant complaining. And the job wasn't that hard to do, but they didn't do it really well, and they were always complaining about it. And I remember I thought, this person is more than capable of doing this work, but they're frustrated, and I couldn't figure it out, and then I realized they were too big for the job. So I started giving them big things to do, helping with the vision, helping with planning. And when they started to do that, they started to blossom a little bit, and then they left. They, like a little birdie, they flew out of the nest. Well, good, because they were too big for the job at the time, but as they grew into it, they got too big for the nest and had to fly away. And sometimes what you do is you'll hire somebody, and they got talents and gifts and skills, and you say, I want that person. Then you bring them in, and then you try to jam them into this small, compartmentalized role, and it's like taking an eagle and tying their wings and then stuffing them in there and getting this walk in the little hamster wheel. And you got this super gifted person, and what are they doing? A small fraction of what they're capable of. And then we wonder why they get frustrated. So I hate to lose that person. Well, you hate to lose that person, you better let them spread their wings. You better give them something to do. You know, we don't just manage by objectives. That's an old way to manage. In Search of Excellence, Tom Peters and I was going to say Peter Sellers, but it was Tom Peters and some other author. I remember the book. If you've never read In Search of Excellence, phenomenal book. How many have read that book? It's a phenomenal book.
Some of the videos. He's
FedEx,
right? Tom Peters?
No. This was written back in probably what, late 70s, early 80s?
80s, I think.
Maybe 80s.
There's a follow-up on In Search of Excellence.
In Search of Excellence, that's the one. In Search of Excellence was amazing. And in Search of Excellence, what they did, they took 10 companies, 7 or 10?
Well, the first one you mentioned is the one that they looked at a bunch of different companies.
Which one was that?
What did you say?
I thought I said Search of Excellence.
But the one you named before that?
Management by Objectives. Management by Objectives was the principle that they supported in Search of Excellence. But anyway, they talked about goal setting and then managing your business towards a goal. But they also took these companies in Search of Excellence, and they looked at what made them unique. And they came up with 7 key things that each one of these companies, these successful companies, did that made them successful. And they varied from company to company. But you know, some of it was a little bit dated and went back to the turn of the 50s and 60s Japanese business model, and you know, it was heavy on management by objectives. Now, what people are finding is we don't manage people by just giving them objectives. We manage people by finding what their skill sets are and then developing roles according to their skill sets. So this is important. We say, well, why are you getting into all this in a Bible study? Because God created each one of these people that we interact with. God created you in your workplace and gave you wings. You may be frustrated because you're in a job that's frankly too small for you. Or maybe you haven't thought to ask who you work for to give you something a little bigger to do. And I'll be honest with you. In one of my last roles, I went into my employer's office and I sat down and I said to him, hey, give me something to do. He said, what do you want to do? I said, give me something you need to get done. And he said, I need you to train all these people in sales. I said, I'll create a curriculum. I'll set the schedule. I'll come up with how many weeks you want? He said, well, 5 or 4. I don't remember how many he said. And I said, done, I'll do it. And I'd never done that before, sales training. I know how to sell. I'd never done sales training. So now I had to go back to my office and figure out everything I've done, write down what I did. And most of what I did was wrong. That's how I learned to do it right. So I couldn't use half the stuff that I knew. So I had to find out what other people did right that helped them do it, that I learned so that we could create some curriculum. So I did that. I had a blast. And it energized me. What energized me was doing something bigger, something that fit me, what God created me to do, and something that was a little bit beyond me. How many understand what I'm driving at tonight? Finding purpose in work, I think, is one of the most important things. Now, you hear every now and then someone on Instagram, they'll come on there and they'll say this. They'll say something like this. You'll never work another day in your life if you find something you love to do and figure out a way to get paid to do it. So I wrote him, how do I get paid for sitting on a beach? That's not happiness. You know, finding something. Listen, I love to play guitar. I could never make a living at it. I don't think I could ever make a living at it. Wanted to when I was younger. But, you know, that whole world. Thank God I didn't have the talent to do it. That world is a crazy world, you know. But God has something for everybody to do. And finding the things that you really like. There's some truth in that. Finding something you really love to do, but then finding what God's purpose is in it, and stretching to a point where you can discover something big about God and big about yourself. One of the most important things I have ever done as a young man was back in Plattsburgh, New York. I don't think I've ever told any of you this. I think one of the most important things that was a defining moment in my life was at Plattsburgh Air Force Base, and this is what happened. There was a group of guys that were working in the same squadron that I was at, and one of them's name was Jim Dahl, D-A-H-L. Close, but no cigar. He had some friends, and he introduced me to these other guys in squadron. So every now and then on a Saturday, we'd all get together, and we'd cook hamburgers or whatever, and so one Friday night, he said, hey, a bunch of us are going up into the mountains and we're going to do some rock climbing. Why don't you come with us and we'll show you how to rock climb? I said, rock climbing? What are you talking about, like hiking? He said, no. He said, rock climbing. I said, okay, rock climbing. He said, what do you want me to wear? He said, well, for the first time, you wear sneakers, but when we get you up there, we'll show you what we do and the kind of stuff that you'll need to pick up. I said, okay. So you go, the first day we get down to this place in the mountains, and there's a boulder. It's about the size of this, about as high as maybe this pipe, big boulder. And, you know, I'm seeing there's like chalk on certain parts of it and cracks and creases. And this guy is there with us, and he's saying, now, Jerry, when you start to climb this boulder, I'm like, climb the boulder? He said, there's certain grips, like putting your hand in the crack and expanding your hand to hold yourself, or, you know, different fingertip grips that you use, and you're going to climb this boulder today. I said, what if I slide off the boulder? I said, well, we're going to rope you. Here's a harness. They put the harness on you, the carabiners. The guy up top is up there, and he's, you know, pulling the rope. And as you come up, he's taking rope and, you know, holding it across his waist so it doesn't slide. And I climbed that boulder. And I got to the top of the boulder. My heart was in my throat. My head was in the clouds. I felt like, you know, like I had just whooped Napoleon. You know, I felt like a conqueror. I got up on top of that rock and I could not believe, number one, I couldn't believe I'd done it. Second, I had overcome a fear I didn't even know I had. So we get back down the rock and I said, are we coming back next week? He said, yeah, we'll come back next week. And he said, but you're not going to climb the boulder next week. I said, oh, I'm not? He said, no. And he turned around and said, you're going to climb that wall next week. I'm like, I'm going to climb that wall. And for 4 or 5 weeks, it was something a little more and a little more and a little more. And I ended up buying the rock climbing rope. I had the harness. I had the carabiners. I had the shoes with the rubber bottoms, you know. And, of course, you got to be like 160 pounds to do that. Now it's like if you can't get your foot over your knee, you can't rock climb. So that's the test. So, you know, but, you know, I can, you know, your foot is as high as your head and you're stretched out. I climbed up this chimney. You know what a chimney is? When two rock faces are like that and that you've got to get on one wall and on the other, like kind of like across the way and walk up the wall and alternate. It was unbelievable. Always tied with that. And then the last week I rappelled down the side of Whiteface. And that was probably maybe 15, 20 stories. And rappelling was a rush. Like, wow. I bring that up because that's probably one of the most important things I've ever done as a young man. Joining the Air Force was a big deal. That was important. I overcame a lot. I had to learn a lot of things. I made a lot of mistakes. But boy, that rock climbing, that was a defining moment for me because I was looking at things I was afraid of and forcing myself to do them. And these guys were there just saying, yeah, you can do this. We're going to be here. We're going to help you. You kind of like the church should be like that, shouldn't it? Shouldn't a church do that? Hey, we'll hold the rope. You want to go on the mission field? We'll hold your ropes. Karen and I always talk about holding the ropes. That's where that came from. You know, prayer is holding on to the ropes for the missionary, and we believe in holding on the ropes. So that was such an important thing. If you ever get an opportunity to rock climb or rappel, do it. You'll love it. The other thing you ought to try to do, and I wish I had done this, was parachuting. And there one morning in tech school, my buddy Lou Lupo wakes up. He says to me, I got to go down and sign up for this program. I said, what's the program? He said, it's parachuting. Come with me. I said, what? Jump out of a perfectly good airplane? I don't think so. You go ahead. I'll be here. He talked me into going down there and signing up. And then the training was the following week. I think there were 2 weeks of training for it. And I didn't go to the training. I backed out because I was scared to death. And I regretted that. And that's why when I got to Plattsburgh after that and I had an opportunity to rock climb, I decided to take it because I didn't want another thing like that to happen. I didn't want to chicken out on something again. So anyway, I say all that to say, find your rock and climb it. Find the challenging things and do them. And don't be afraid of taking risks and don't be afraid of calculated risks with wisdom, but don't be afraid to try those things. And let people around you experiment with spreading their wings. Don't divide your life into the secular and the sacred. They are not separated. Your work is not any different than the rest. Your work is part of your life. You know, after the fall in Genesis chapter 3, God said that the labor that he would do would now result, it wouldn't be as easy. The woman would have pains and labor, and the man would have a difficult time working. Thorns and thistles would ruin some of his plantings, and he would be the sweat of his brow, and it's the curse, it's the fall of the curse. And somebody says, Why we're subject to the curse. Well, I'm gonna read three bombshell statements from Colossians 3 that that we've gone over, but we may have not looked at them in the light of work. Back in Colossians chapter 3, starting in verse 10. Boy, how did I mess this up? Jeez. Darn, did I put the wrong reference down? Okay, somebody's got to look this verse up for me. It's I'll give you the words. Those who rely on the works of the law are under a curse. Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law. Where's that? Yeah, I think it is.
It's Galatians 3:10.
Galatians, that's right. Okay. Thank you. For some reason, I wrote down Colossians in my notes. Oh, I have Galatians right there. I'm looking at the top Colossians with the different verse. All right, Galatians 3 then. Galatians 3:10. Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law, having become a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree, that the blessing of Abraham might come upon the Gentiles, that we might receive the promise of the Spirit through faith. This is really quite amazing. Go back to verse 10. For as many are under the works of the law are under a curse. For it is written, cursed is everyone who does not continue in all things which are written in the book of the law to do them. But that no man is justified by the law in the sight of God is evident. For the just shall live by faith. Yet the law is not of faith. Did you hear? Did you see that? This is a really critical thing. The law is not of faith. The man who does them shall live by them. Here's the three bombshell statements. Number one in verse 10. Those who are under the works of the law are under a curse. Now, what does that mean? We have to understand what the works of the law are. Is the works of the law a positive thing? Let me just explain this in a nutshell to you, okay? The works of the law here doesn't refer to obedience that comes from faith. The works of the law here refers to self-reliant efforts at obedience, which are opposite of faith. Paul is saying that it's not a faith. Works of the law is not a faith. Attempting to work under the law is not a faith. Legalism, it takes no faith to be legalistic. To be a legalistic Christian takes no faith. It doesn't take any faith to cut your hair and judge everyone with long hair. It doesn't take any faith to have a certain version of the Bible and make sure and call everybody else losers that don't have that version. It doesn't take any faith to do that kind of thing. It doesn't take any faith for a man to say, wives obey your husbands. Blah, 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 blah. Don't take any faith to say that. You say, isn't that a Bible verse? Sure. Sure it is. But as Jason brought out, it's not a duty. It's not it's the duty of the husband to love the wife, not the duty of the husband to make sure the wife obeys him. Listen, you're getting all bent out of shape on a duty that doesn't belong to you. And Christians do that all the time. All the time. So the works of the law doesn't refer to obedience that comes by faith. It's not a good thing. Paul, this is a negative thing. Paul's giving it a negative connotation because the works of the law didn't require any faith. For you to say, well, if you're not circumcised, then you're not a Christian. Or for you, no one says that anymore, but that's what they were saying in Galatia. You've got to do the law. You have to obey the Sabbath. Well, they say that. There's a whole group that have that in this. Oh, about the seventh day, there's a whole group of believers that have placed themselves back under the curse of the law, and it's not faith, and it's not positive at all. Second bombshell statement is this. Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law. You know what that means, folks, tonight? That means that as far as the sweat of my brow and as far as thorns choking what we do, that doesn't affect us anymore. It may happen around us because we're in the world, but it doesn't have any internal impact on my soul any longer. It doesn't have to affect. When something goes wrong in the workplace, it doesn't have to affect me. When the thorns come up and choke what you've been working on, if you manage a business or you've run a department or if you're even if you're a nurse or somebody who's involved with any business, and you have this happen all the time. Say, well, we started to do this thing and then the thorns sprung up and choked it. You know, somebody blew it. Somebody made a mistake. Somebody didn't tell me this happened, that happened, whatever the case may be. Say, hey, guess what? You're not under the curse of the law. You're going to have to deal with the frustrations, but you're not under the curse of the law. The third bombshell statement is in verse 14. That we might receive the promise of the Spirit through faith. That's a bombshell statement. Let's try to understand these and realize a couple of things here. At work, we can find amazing blessing, fruit, and peace because we're not under the curse of the law. We can find understanding our purpose there and glorify God in everything. And that is the purpose of work, to bring glory to God. He made us. He's a worker. He's made us to work. I hope you understood my opening comments about the faith movement. Number two, we find this purpose to demonstrate his grace to the living and the lost. This is a high purpose in the workplace. You're responsible to demonstrate the grace of God to the living and to the lost. Who are the living? I'm of the living. Who are the lost? We have them in our life. I have one particular person. I don't care if the thing falls flat on its face. If I don't show grace to this one person, I have failed as a business owner. Demonstrate the grace of God to the living and to the lost. And here's number three. We work to appropriate the assets God has stored away for us in his plan to bless you. Now this is Philippians 4:19. My God shall supply your need. We had a building at Griffiths called the Supply Building. You know what was in the Supply Building?
Supplies.
Everything. Supplies. Remember that joke? Supplies. So everything was in there. New combat boots. Fatigues. Anything you could need. They had everything, all the tools. They had everything for those who had to carry weapons, whatever the case may be. Everything was in supply. And it was there. It was all there. You know what you had to do to get it?
Yes.
You had to ask for it. And then you had, in the Air Force, you had to be given what was called an appropriations form. And then you filled out the appropriation form. And if the appropriation was approved, you could get what you needed out of supply. Appropriation is an important principle. Appropriation. That's how we go and get what we need from supply. Now, the faith movement will tell you all it takes to appropriate is faith. I say that's not the case. When it comes to these assets we're talking about, when it comes to money, when it comes to having things in your life, yeah, you need faith to start. But you know what else you need to appropriate? You need a work ethic. And you need a right attitude. Back in Colossians, doing things unto the Lord, not unto men. That's the litmus test. Are you working unto the Lord or unto men? Are you doing it as an eye pleaser, a men pleasing eye satisfier? What was it? Eye pleasing men's servant? What was it? Colossians. Hold on a second. Don't do it as what's. How does it say that? Eye servant, a man-pleasing eye servant, or an eye-serving man-pleaser. Is that how you're doing? Is that what you're doing at work? You're just working when they see you? And when no one's watching, you sit down on the bench and have a Snickers bar and wait for somebody to come and tell you to do something? Doing the very minimal? Doing the minimum? I remember there was a saying used to drive me nuts when I was in the service. Good enough for government work. I hated that because I was growing in the Lord and I hated that. Well, good enough for government work. And that meant shoddy. No one cares. This is fine. This is acceptable. This is, we're not here to glorify your God. We just slap the thing on the wall. Now, if your boss says, here's what he wants you to do, leave the drywall so the seam is showing, make sure there's all kinds of gaps. Then you're not sinning if you do that. But I'll tell you, if you could do a better job, that'd be good. Because we're doing things unto the Lord and not unto men. To appropriate the assets that God has in store for you and I, yes, it takes faith, but it also takes work. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 11 says, make it your ambition to lead a quiet life. Mind your own business and work with your hands. How about that? That ought to be the top three things in every employee manual. That's the new verse for the Legacy Agency Employee Manual, Karen, right there. It's lead a quiet life, mind your business, and work with your hands. If you could get your employees to do this, shut up, mind your business, and do your job. And that's kind of what Paul is saying here. This sounds like a verse our friend would use, isn't it?
He said that a few times.
Oh, yeah, he just like that, too. Mind, make it your ambition. Make it your goal to lead a quiet life, mind your own business, and work with your hands. 1 Thessalonians 4:11. That's a great attitude to have at work. How about this? Proverbs 14:23. All hard work brings profit. Boy, what do the faith folks say about that? And I say faith folks, we're faith folks, but what are those people who are imbalanced in their belief about that? Mere talk leads only to poverty. And I can tell you this, most of those people who are trapped in those movements, who believe those movements, they don't have any money. They keep going because they're hoping to strike it rich at one of the conventions or something. Most of them are broke because they've given most of their money away to these speakers. And what drives me crazy? I was in Africa, and these guys would come in Africa and wipe out a whole city, take all the money, all the disposable income these Christians had, convince them all that God would bless them if they gave all the money to this charlatan. Charlatan. Benny Hinn, class A charlatan, went into Finland. And boy, he ruined a city of Finland, Christians, churches in Finland, ruined them. They ended up fighting with each other and everything else. Why? Because he went in there and divided them and told them, you got to give your money and, blah, 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 blah. And it's all this faith movement. You know what? How about this? Lead a quiet life, mind your business, work with your hands. All hard work brings profit. Hello? Look at that verse, Proverbs 14:23, both of you two, especially you two over there. And you, Julia, you're another one. Proverbs 14:23, read it.
Proverbs 14:23. And all labor there is profit, but idle chatter leads only to poverty.
Yeah. Yep. Pretty good, isn't it? Hard work leads to
profit.
How about this one? Annika, you read this one. Proverbs 10, verse 4. And then, Julia, you can read Proverbs 6, 10 to 11.
He who has a slack hand becomes poor, but the hand of the diligent makes rich.
Say it again.
He who has a slack hand becomes poor.
What's a slack hand mean? It doesn't mean this, right? What's a slack hand?
Lazy
hands make for poverty. Diligent hands bring wealth. Lazy hands, poverty. Lazy, poor. Say it with me. Lazy, poor. You're lazy, you're what?
Poor.
Broke. Lazy, say it. Broke.
Work hard.
Work hard.
Profit.
Work hard. Cash on hand. Okay. This isn't rocket science. Proverbs 6, 10 to 11. Read it, Julia.
A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So shall your poverty come on you like a prowler, and your need like an armed man.
Yeah. See? Lazy. I had a friend of mine years ago, and he would go home in the middle of the day and read magazines while the teams were out working. And boy, I watched him just crumble. His life just fell to pieces. Psalm 128, verse 2. Maria, read that one. Yeah, you know, it's nothing like when you've worked hard and you get to enjoy a little bit of it. Isn't that nice? It's a nice thing. It's a nice thing when that happens. Yep. Liam, you read Philippians 4:13. You can do what?
All things.
Yeah? You believe that verse? Do you believe that verse? What do you think all means in the original language?
The easy ones.
The easy stuff. Nope. All things. Psalm 127 says, unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrow, for so he gives his beloved sleep. Now, I just want to say a word about workaholism. It is vain to rise up early and work and just work all day, morning, noon, and night. It's vain. Deuteronomy 5, verse 14 says, on the seventh day, it's the Sabbath day of the Lord, on it you shall not work, neither you, your son, your daughter, your male, your female servant, your ox, your donkey, your animals, foreigner. What's the saying there? God saying, you need to rest. Take a break. You need a break. And I remember I said to my dad, I said, Dad, he wanted us to go pick rocks out of the grass in the yard from when we played baseball there. And I said, Dad, come on, Dad, it's Sunday, it's the Sabbath. And my father said, if Jesus can get up on a Sunday morning and move a stone, so can't you. But he also believed in rest. And my dad knew how to take time off. And you know, we didn't do vacations. I don't ever recall going on a vacation. My uncle had a camp on the other side of Long Meadow, and we went for like 2 days. That was it. Never a week-long getaways, vacations where you rest and recuperate. But we did a lot of, we knew how to rest and take it easy. And I think that's important. Nobody should be working 80 hours a week. 100 hours a week. It's not healthy. If you can't get done what you need to get done in a reasonable period of time, yeah, you need to not do something. Pick something to not do. As long as it's not forsaking the assembling of yourselves or doing something your husband needs you to do. All right, any comments or questions? I wanted to take a little bit of a unique approach to work, and I do this every few months. I hit on this topic because so much of us, you know, if you think about it, you probably spend more time at work with your coworkers than you do at home with your family. And, you know, if it's 40 hours a week, you know, there's only 120 hours in a week. So let's see if you're getting 6 hours of sleep and you're getting, in the course of a week, 42 hours, if you had 40, that's 80. That gives you 40 hours of waking time. You're not relaxing all 40 hours. You're doing stuff at the house. You're fixing things. You're going places. If you're, you know, if you're married, if you're a woman, you're cleaning, you're buying stuff. If you're a man, you should be helping her clean, buying stuff. Go to the grocery store. So what does that really leave you for rest? You need 8 hours at least, you know. To carve out in the course of a week 8 hours where you're resting, not sleeping, trying to rest. Figure out a way to relax, you know.